where faith matters. The Rev and the Rabbi. Talk Radio 77 WABC.
Welcome back. I'm Rabbi Joseph Potasnik.
And I'm Reverend A.R. Bernard. Rabbi, today we have a guest who is affectionately known as Pastor Charles. I speak of none other than the Reverend Charles O. Galbraith.
He's Irish.
I want to make sure I pronounce that correctly. He is a senior pastor of Clarendon Road Church in Brooklyn, New York, and was formerly with Alliance Theological Seminary, which was my alma mater. And now he's associate dean and partnering professor. He is at Asbury Seminary. Is that correct?
That's correct, serving as an assistant professor over there.
Okay, well, leave it to me to just wreck an introduction, but we're going to keep it going because he's also part of the God Squad, Rabbi, at the 67th Clergy Council.
I have no problem with the God part of it. I have a real serious problem with the squad.
That's
you
it.
Know, they got to remove that squad.
No, don't take that political. Don't go there, Rabbi. Don't go there. Not at all. But Pastor Galbraith has been in ministry in the community, and that's his passion. We were talking about that before the program started and talked about how, and Rabbi, you understand this, that in our Protestant world, especially here in America, we have these incredibly influential churches who are doing great things nationally and globally, but disconnected from their local communities. And we share, Pastor Galbraith and I share that belief that, you know, charity begins at home. What we do in our local community then should spread out beyond. Reverend Charles O. Galbraith, thank you for being with the Rev and the Rabbi today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Reverend Bernard. Thank you, Rabbi Potasnik. It's an honor to be here. I also have to let you know that I'm first a fan. I listen to you, and so it's a great honor to be able to be on the program. And Rabbi Potasnik, we predate the other squad, just to put that out there.
Thank God. Otherwise, you wouldn't be on the air today with us. I have to tell you, Reverend Bernard, when I hear Pastor Galbraith speak, and I hear you speak, and I see the reception you receive at your respective congregations, I'm uplifted. I say there's hope for the future, because you know, when you look at some of the national numbers in terms of declining attendance, it's very depressing. And yet, neither one of you has that experience in your areas.
Well, I'm going to let the Reverend Galbraith respond to that first.
Yeah, so I've been seeing this and studying this, Rabbi, as we see that there is a disaffiliation and disconnection with religious association kind of across the board. But what we have seen, and I'm thankful for Reverend Bernard's leadership with this, is when people have an experience with a grand narrative and an experience with something that is authentic, we see that there is folks coming around to see what's here. Particularly, I think for us, we saw during the pandemic when everything else seemed to be failing, folks who may have disconnected from a faith in our faith traditions really connected and dialed in, as Reverend Bernard said, because not only have we been present sharing the word, but we've also been doing the work. I'm thankful to be able to be a part of that. And I think there is hope. I'm constantly in the space of trying to see how we can see that hope and imagine it and realize it here in Brooklyn and beyond.
You know, Rabbi, if I may, in response to Pastor Galbraith, you know, Pew Research study came out with a look at church attendance in the religious landscape study is what it was called. And they broke it down by race and ethnicity. And what we hear from Pew Research, from Bonner Research, Reverend Galbraith, you're familiar with Bonner and their work, is not impacting the Black church. Mm-hmm. And the Black church is not monolithic, But it's not impacting the black church in America as much as it is the white church in America. The statistics were in terms of church attendance amongst whites. It is now 34%. And with blacks attending church, it's 47% at least once a week. This is at least once a week.
Why the difference?
If I can jump in, Reverend Bernard.
Yeah, go ahead.
I agree. I actually did see both of those studies, the Pew Research study as well as the Barner study. While we take a look at those distinctives in regards to the black church and the white church, some of my research is actually to argue that I think the broader church can learn from the black church tradition, particularly in regards to its view of sacred text, its affirmation of daily devotion and prayer, as well as its connection towards gathering individually once a week, as we saw those numbers were a bit higher. I think it's particularly in black church traditions, as you're aware, Reverend Bernard, and also Reverend Fantastic, because you've been in many of these congregations, is it's a lived faith. It's not just something that is reflected intellectually, but it's a lived out faith because people are seeking to understand how in their daily experiences, how a faith can be applied and engaged, with. And so I like to call it an embodied faith that is not something that we see just for a weekend, but I need this in a continually and consistent way all throughout the week.
That's interesting because we are having an increasing number of what I call cultural Christians, and Rabbi, you have cultural Jews. Mm-hmm. These are individuals who are identified with a particular faith by virtue of the culture. But in terms of practitioners, another study also done by Pew Research, and Barna did a study as well, shows that blacks are actually involved in practicing their faith, not culturally, but like Reverend Galbraith said, on a daily basis. It's a part of their daily life experience. What do you see happening, Rabbi, in terms of the Jewish faith?
So you use the word, both of you use the word authentic. And I was telling some people that in 2023, Merriam-Webster's dictionary said that was the most popular word, the word being searched the most. People are looking for authenticity. They're looking for something that, I think as Reverend Galbraith said, impacts their lives in a meaningful way, not tangentially, not superficially, but has a deeply resonating spirit. And I think you'll find in the Jewish world, there is that yearning for authenticity as well. There are many who'll say, I'm not there to hear what the New York Times says. I'm not there to hear, some political story. I'm there to hear what my Bible says to me about issues of the day. I'm there to pray with people who take prayer seriously. So where you find that authentic spirit, where you find that people are talking about the real, they're going through the tradition and saying, this is what the Torah says. These are the commentaries. That has a greater appeal than just, Judaism light, if you want to call it that. So I hear what you're saying, and I think there is some similarity in the Jewish world. I also think with young people, I think some people have found there is a great void in the secular world.
They can be
successful,
yeah,
but at the end of the day, so what? How do I feel validated? How do I feel that I'm contributing to society if all I'm doing is making a living, rather than some people say, than making a life? So I think that's where we share that common bond.
And Rabbi, I think you're exactly on to something. Reverend Bernard referenced a study, and I think in that same study, it talks about the rise of the nuns, those who have no religious affiliation, but they're not atheists or they're not opposed to faith tradition, but they're searching for something the more. That one writer talks about not the irrational, but the more than rational. This idea of something beyond just their daily experience of working and living, and so they're looking and searching. So you hear those terms as spiritual, but not religious. And when I hear that, I hear people who are seeking for something more and something real.
It is true, and they're making that distinction only as a rejection of organized religion, established religious systems. We did look. I'm a baby boomer. We did it in the 70s. We were anti-establishment. We were calling for radical change, and the 60s. Was a decade of every revolution imaginable. But at the same time, as you know, Reverend Galbraith, there was the Jesus movement. There were hippies who were, you know, getting a guitar and, you know, sitting out in the park. And all of a sudden, you had thousands, even tens of thousands at some time, gathering to embrace the faith. So it's interesting how we could have somewhat of, I won't go as far as saying apostasy, but a moving away from what has been established and looking for new ways of understanding and interacting with their faith. And I think that's what these millennials are experiencing. Rabbi, how is it in the Jewish faith?
Yeah, I think the same thing. You know, you and I, Reverend, have spoken about value. Give me something of value and I will participate. And people are looking for that spiritual value. You know, they may not be joining gyms, for example, the millennials, but they're hiring trainers. They want something that impacts their lives. And I think when they look at a congregation, they say, you know, I'm here because I want to understand what it means to be a Jew. I want to understand what the Torah says to me about daily living and how I should live in a world that also is not majority Jewish. You know, how do I protect my identity in that world? So I think if you provide people with that enriching experience, if they walk away feeling renewed, refreshed, you have accomplished something that is going to get them to return.
I agree with this as well, Rabbi. And I also think that folks are looking, even though they're looking in different ways, they also are looking for our faith traditions to be who we say we are. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. King has that famous line that he's asking America to be who we say we are on paper. I think that many millennials, Generation Z and Alphas, are asking for us to be who we say we're supposed to be. I think when we show up in those spaces, as I know both of you have demonstrated and illustrated through interreligious dialogue, friendship, as well as advocacy in times of difficulty, that folks get renewed faith in each other, but also in our various religious traditions.
So you touch on the interfaith aspect of our work. And here we are talking about the richness of our respective traditions. Do you not find that there are those who are skeptical of interfaith relationships because they feel somehow you're going to compromise your identity, you're going to dilute who you are so you can receive the satisfaction or approval of others, that you're not really going to say who you are because you may be, at a state of difference with others. You're not going to agree on things. Do you find that to be so on some level?
I think, to be honest with you, I think sometimes I get that from folks who do not live in New York City. Mm-hmm. I think in New York City, because we are deeply connected, and for many of us who are doing the work to impact folks' lives, we need each other. We are deeply connected to one another. And I think what I try to do and try to model is to fully affirm my faith tradition. I do not try to water it down. I believe what I believe. I affirm what I affirm. I teach what I teach. But I also honor and respect my other brothers and sisters. And when we find that there's places and spaces where we're called to be in agreement on moral issues, I think that, you know, it is one of those writers who says we need a moral voice, but unfortunately, many of our religious traditions have caught laryngitis. When we get our voices together for moral issues that matter, it makes major impact.
No, that is very, very, very true. Do you find that there is a change taking place in churches that at one time were very strict in terms of their own tribe, their own clan, their own group, whether it be denominationally or some fellowship of churches, and they felt that it would be a violation of their doctrine to find common ground with another religious group who may believe things that are diametrically opposed, or in some cases, a degree of difference. Do you find that that's changing, Reverend Galbraith?
I can't speak to everywhere, Rev, but I think it's changing when you have issues and concerns that matter. You guys spoke about the God Squad before, and the God Squad is a group of pastors and other ministry leaders here in Central Brooklyn with the express purpose of ending gun violence here in Central Brooklyn. We come from different denominations, different backgrounds. And when I first came to it, I was like, well, there's an Episcopal church, and this is a Roman Catholic church, and this is an Evangelical church, and a Pentecostal church, and a church with folks from Jamaica, and a church with folks from Guyana. But we had a collective need of violence that was taking place within Central Brooklyn. And so regardless of our various traditions, we had a mission. We had a direction. And so as a result of that, we came together as a coalition to affect and impact gun violence. And we're thankful that to be one of the larger groups in the city to seek to end gun violence. I think that's just an illustration, example of faith traditions coming together from different backgrounds, from different traditions that would many times would be skeptical in regards to their doctrinal positions, but in regards to the sociological practice that is present, they've got to get engaged. And if we don't get engaged, we all going to suffer because we're all in the same neighborhood.
So let me ask you both the following. The intersection between politics and faith, or the faith community, the role of politics within the church, politicians speaking in the church, I also mean the synagogue as well. But from your standpoint, where you are there boundaries? I mean, can you endorse or quasi-endorsement by having someone there, you know, where people know where you stand? Or do you limit it to the issues and not the individuals?
Reverend Galbraith?
Oh, this is good. We're getting into it. But I also have to say I've taken my model from Reverend Bernard. I'm not just saying that because I'm on his show and your show, Rabbi. But I was actually a student to go to his church when I was in seminary to be able to learn and understand how we interact with the powers. I believe that everybody knows their role. Everybody understands and recognizes their responsibility. From my perspective, my position is not to advocate for an individual, but rather to advocate for a community. And so part of that advocacy is to be able to hear information from our elected officials, to support those who are advocating for our community, as well as to call into accountability those who are not. We have, as Reverend Bernard does, have elected officials who are members of our congregation and church. And when there is a particular issue, we champion when they are doing what we believe the community needs to do. But when we find that there are issues and challenges, I just had to do it the other week concerning the migrant crisis, as well as a SUNY Downstate Hospital. We call out the moral clarion voice to say we need assistance and advocacy on this particular area. I believe that it's supposed to be informational. but it also we're supposed to advocate and be that voice that speaks for those in our tradition, we say, who cannot speak for themselves. To be that one who speaks for the marginalized and those who are disconnected from these various traditions. But I would love to hear what Reverend Bernard has said, because he's been doing this and doing it well for much longer than I.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is when Rabbi talked about boundaries. We set boundaries. We only give each politician 3 minutes to speak. So that is the first boundary that we enforce. We've done the best we can with it, but some of them, I may have to get one of those long shepherd rods with the hook at the end.
Yes, sir.
But I will brief them and tell them, look, I don't want you bashing another candidate or political party. Talk about policies. Talk about the merits of what you do and how you do it. So I've been very, very firm. There's only been one occasion, gentlemen, that I have actually literally put a politician out of my service. And this was about 24 years ago. I gave him the opportunity to share. I'm not going to call any names. Gave him the opportunity to share. And then he sat down on the front row, crossed his legs, and went to sleep. I removed him. I said, out, and had the my security come. And, of course, he was shocked, later issued an apology. But, you know, we will not be used as a platform to promote their agenda or get across a message. It has to be, going back to our first theme for this conversation, authenticity. There must be an authentic representation of what you bring to the community to make a difference. Reverend Galbraith was talking about his prophetic role. We have a prophetic responsibility to advocate for our communities. And let me say this, Rabbi, so you'll appreciate this. I'm sure Reverend Galbraith understands this because he's part of the Black church tradition in America. The Black church not only has shared faith and shared values that bond us together, but also shared experiences as persons of color living in America. And that experience over the last couple hundred years has really, really caused the church to be a foundation for change, for protection, for guidance, you know, on and on and on. And I think you mirror that in the Jewish community because you experience in a different way the same marginalization and segregation that we experience as persons of color in America.
And we knew that the synagogue was the place where we could find that refuge. The synagogue was the place, you know, historically, synagogues were also a place for lost and found items. If you lost something, you know, you hopefully would find it left by someone else at the synagogue. And it's the same with individuals, lost and found. There are people who are feeling so lost because of their experiences, but they know they could find, you know, that safe, sacred space, that support from others when they walked into a house, a Jewish house of worship. I know the Reverend has to go. I just want to ask you one last question, if I could.
Wait,
first, Rabbi, I would just always say thank you because you're always giving me extra sermons. Thank you. I'll take it.
Yeah, listen, the Rev does it all the time, but he never gives me any credit. But I know you have to run. You had the opportunity this past week to meet Rachel and John Goldberg Poland, whose son Hirsch is being held hostage in Gaza. You bless them. Talk about, if you could, the impact of that meeting for you.
Thank you for that, Rabbi. I'm still reflecting on that meeting. I really believe it was a sacred space to hear a mother's pain, to hear her hurt, but yet also to hear her hope and her deep abiding faith. What I shared with Sister Rachel was what that experience was for me was deeply religiously educative. It was a moment of a lived psalm. She talked about singing the psalms as she waited and hoped for her son Hirsch's release. And I heard a lived psalm in her speaking, in her sharing, in her care and remembrance of her son. I did have the opportunity to bless them. And our congregation, we have a special time of prayer for our world, our community, and we added Hirsch to that reflection of prayer this week. I was deeply moved by a sacred moment to hear a cry of a mother, yes, for her son, but also for all the hostages that were taken, as well as by such generosity and grace by all those who are suffering violence and pain that she lifted up.
Family was most grateful to be surrounded by interfaith leaders. That's what they wanted. They met many of the Jewish leaders, but they said, could we please meet with interfaith leaders? And I was happy to make sure that you were included. Thank you.
I was honored to be there.
And that's what it's going to take, creating safe spaces for healthy discussion and even debate when necessary. You know, the climate of the times that we're in is trying to rob houses of worship from being that safe space, the sacred space. And that's something we all must join hands together and push back against.
Amen.
Reverend Galbraith, it has been, now we've been pronouncing it Galbraith, Galbraith. Is it Galbraith?
Of those. Our family comes, received it from the South, and so there are different variations. I receive it all. Charles is good for me.
But what is the Galbraith? O? What does the initial O stand for?
Oliver.
Oh, okay.
Of course.
Oliver, yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Right? Come on. Of course. Well, it's been great having you on the program. Yeah. Thank you for all that you do locally in your congregation. And my prayer is that congregation continue to grow. And I think you and I can say thank God for that, because there are other congregations across the country that are dwindling in terms of numbers. Mm-hmm. And we're experiencing growth and continued impact on our communities.
His initials is COG. What a cog in the wheel he is, huh?
You see, this is what he does. I write it down. Of course, putting it all towards his retirement.
You know what? I think people listening to this interview, and let me extend it also to your son, Jamal, Pastor Brown. When they hear these people speak, they say there's hope for the future, that you can look at some of the polls, but that doesn't give you the entire story. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you for being on the program, Reverend, and all the best.
It was a high honor to be with two folks who not only I look up to, but who model it continually and consistently. And the whole city, we were in a meeting 2 weeks ago, and the whole city continues to look to you as a model of hope for our city. So thank you.
Thank you, my friend.
Thank you.